Well, welcome everybody. My name's Stuart Corbridge. I'm one of the pro-directors here at LSE, and it's a great pleasure for me formally to welcome you to this very happy occasion, this celebration of 20 years in the life of Destin, or more accurately, 19 years in the life of Destin, and 1 year and 1 week in the life of Doid. I'm out of touch, James. The Department of International Development, of which Tim Dyson is the first and continuing head of department, was founded on the 1st of September 2010. And the fact, of course, that it is now a Department of International Development, even if the acronym isn't entirely to everybody's liking, including James Putzel in the front row, nonetheless signifies that this has been a tremendous success story within the school, and I think it symbolises a much more general success story for the study of development, development studies, international development in the UK and more generally. The topic of this celebration is, as you know, responding to the crisis in international development. I think Simon Maxwell is going to pick up later on whether or not we actually need the word crisis in that sentence. But the agenda for today and tomorrow, which my colleagues will take us through in a moment, follows on the inauguration of the celebrations last night by Professor Alex de Waal, who gave the Alistair Barclay Memorial Lecture. So we're very grateful to Alex for taking on that task, and we're especially grateful to the family of Alistair Barclay for continuing to endow this lecture. From the school's point of view, as I said, Destin ID is a tremendous success story. We're going to be hearing shortly from Meghnad, Professor Lord Desai, about the founding and early growth of Destin. We know, of course, that it happened 20 years ago, but it really was a very small enterprise with a very few key figures. Now, the Department of International Development at the LSE has more than 25 full-time equivalent members of staff. It has four main degree programs, including the MPA program, which we share with economics and with government. And it has a very large and a very vibrant student body, and it's a very difficult set of programs to get into. To give you some idea of how ID now stands at the school, LSE has 22 academic departments. And in terms of scale, international development now at the LSE would be in the larger half of departments by size. So we're talking about a very considerable achievement, I think, over a 20-year period. And it's wonderful to see so many people catching my eye as well, who've been central to the story of the foundation and growth of Destin. We do owe a special thanks, I think, to two lords, Meghnad Desai to my left and Professor Lord Nick Stern, both of whom were in at the start of the development of Destin. Presumably there's a causality there that goes found a development studies institute and become a lord. So maybe some other people will take this on. I noticed James Putzel sitting down here towards the front row. James has been associated with Destin and ID pretty well from the early days. Very close friend John Harris, who's come over from Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. Also, I'm looking around, Drusilla Daly, in fact, Drew, if she's here, probably is the most long-standing servant of Destin and ID. And those of us that are familiar with the department will know that without Drew, without Sue Redgrave, without Steph Davis, and a bunch of other people over time, the institute come department would be nothing like the institute and department that it has become. So I'd like to extend a thanks to all of them. As it happened yesterday, I was speaking to some alums of the school in Washington, D.C., and I met a guy who is the now works as a chief financial officer for a major bank, but was the chief financial officer for the World Bank. And when he was at the school, I think between 1969 and 71, he was taught econometrics by you, Meghnad, but his teacher of development economics was Peter Bauer. And I think this reminds us that Destin builds on some, you know, quite deep foundations. If we think about who's been associated with the school in terms of development, Peter Bauer, W. Arthur Lewis, I mean, there's a large number of pioneers of development that have been associated with the school, and whether they were in any way at the back of your minds when you founded Destin is something that we'll perhaps hear about shortly. I'm not going to take up too much of your time further because I'm going to hand over to Tim Dyson and then to Meghnad. But in terms of a very happy formal duty that comes to me, I'd particularly like to thank Sean Fox, Susan Holt and Teddy Brett, who've really done, I think, most of the donkey work to make sure that this rather large event has come to pass. So thank you all. I'm delighted, of course, that so many of our former students are going to be with us over the course of 2 days, both to take part in the big academic sessions today, but also in the academic and alumni sessions tomorrow. We're very happy to welcome back to the school Dr. Justin Lin, the current chief economist of the World Bank, who's regularly been to the school whilst he's been in Washington. We have other old friends coming back. I've already mentioned John Harris, Francisco Gutierrez, Peter Evans sitting down here right in front of me, Simon Maxwell from ODI, Michael Lipton from IDS, and Neera Chandoki from Delhi. And it's also a great pleasure to welcome perhaps less regular visitors, Jennifer Widner from Princeton and Alan Lipietz from SEPRAMAP in Paris. Just on a very quick personal note, I would like to say that the 4 years that I had in Destin before becoming pro-director were the happiest years of my academic life, and I think that is really down to both the students and to the great collegiality of staff members within Destin. It was and it is a great pleasure to be associated with Destin and ID. So I'm delighted to help inaugurate this event. I'm delighted that you're all here, and I'll now hand over to Tim Dyson, the current head of international development, to take us through the next stage of this prologue. So welcome, everybody. Hope you have a great couple of days.
Yeah, well, thanks very much, Stuart. I'm going to echo quite a few of the things that Stuart said, but first and foremost, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this 20th anniversary conference of what was formerly Destin, as now, as Stuart said, the Department of International Development, or as we call it, ID, simple ID, no DOITs. The welcome is particularly warm for our distinguished guests and friends and speakers, and for past staff, and in particular, I think, for the large number of alumni that are essentially going to run the Saturday of this event. In addition, most of the people who've been at the helm, as it were, acting as a director or now head of department, are also present here today, most of them at least. Of course, first and foremost, there's Meghnad, who did so much to establish the place in the first place. But also present are my predecessors, John Harris, James Putzel, Joe Beale, and of course, Stuart. In the 20 years since ID was established, more than 2,500 students have taken either the MSc in Development Studies or the MSc in Development Management. In addition, there are now actually 5 joint degree programs, MSc programs. There is the highly successful MPA in International Development, which has been running for about 3 years. This year, the department is introducing an MSc in International Development and Humanitarian Emergencies. 73 people have graduated with PhDs, and there are currently 55 registered research students. Well, if you add up the people who either have been students or who currently are on those various programs, then I can tell you that the number comes to slightly more than 4,000. Now, in the very early days, quite a few of our graduates went on to work in the financial sector and international banking. And I know that this came as a surprise to members of the Institute at that time. But of course, as time has gone by, so the scope has broadened very, very considerably. And so today, our alumni are working, for example, as researchers and academics, government administrators, journalists, editors, policy advisors. We have alumni working in all of the main national development agencies, and of course, many international organizations within the UN system and, for example, the World Bank. In addition, a significant number of our alumni work for NGOs, both the major ones like SCF or Oxfam, but also several alumni have gone on to establish NGOs of their own. in a few days' time, one of our very first MSc students, Perna Sen, will be rejoining the department as director of the Program for African Leadership. So a very broad range of development work. Okay, so the number's 4,000 and it's 20 years. You lot can do the maths. And the figure of 4,000 is the more impressive because for most of that time, as Stuart suggested, the number of academic staff has actually been really rather small. It was only a handful at the beginning, and when I joined about a decade ago, the number had come up to about 10 to 12. Today, as a department, the number of academics stands at about 24, 25. Okay, it's about that. And of course, in addition, there are associated research staff. In the past, of course, there was the Crisis States Research Program, and today there is the Justice and Security Research Program, both of which have been funded by DFI. Now, the efficiency of the department derives partly from the streamlined administrative arrangements that came with the establishment of a young institution. But the efficiency also owes a great deal, a very great deal, to the extremely high caliber of our administrative staff. And I did ask those staff to come today, and I'm in fact even this morning in addition, and it's a pity they're not here. But as Stuart said, Drew Daly has been with us right from the start, and about a decade ago she was joined by Sue Redgrave. And everyone who's been with us for the last decade knows of Sue and Drew, or Drew and Sue, absolutely central. They have recently been joined by Susan Holt, who has done so much for this to help in arranging this meeting. And then, of course, there is our departmental manager, Stephanie Davis, joining us, nodding his head like mad. Anyone who's been in my current position knows, can attest to her many strengths and utter indispensability. There's also, dare I say it, my 24 or so academic colleagues. They're a damn good bunch. They produce high-quality research. And if you want to find out for that yourself, go to the bookshop, because partly in relation to our visiting speakers, but also in relation to my academic colleagues, the bookshop has got together as many books that we've published, that they've published over time, and you can get them at a discount rate. Okay. And it's not just research, because the courses that are taught by my colleagues on a range of sexy and important subjects are as much appreciated by students as courses taught anywhere else in the LSE. And that's really true. Fantastic. Well, I said that Drew has been here from the start, and Teddy has been with us for almost as long. He, indeed, in the early days, at times has really been acting director for periods, and he's been obviously absolutely crucial as an intellectual force and for the development management stream within the department. And as Stuart intimated, we owe him a great debt in being so prominent in putting this whole meeting together. Well, Teddy's title, and it was Teddy's title, Simon. Teddy's title for this conference is Responding to the Crisis in International Development. And in finishing, I thought I would allow myself four brief observations, because I'm not particularly optimistic about the future. So here are my four brief observations. The first observation is that the world economy has seen several important turning points, or points of inflection, in the period since the end of the Second World War. A particularly important inflection point occurred around 1973-74, and subsequently world per capita economic growth has been on a distinctly lower path. I think it's quite likely that 2008-2009 also represents another point of inflection, and I know a lot of people think that. We may be entering a new and more difficult era. The second observation is that, in any event, conventional estimates of GDP growth can be deceiving. For example, in that they neglect the depreciation of natural capital, such as fresh water resources. Estimated trends in, quotation, genuine wealth per capita that include natural capital made by people like Kenneth Arrow and Partha Dasgupta are much more sobering as regards trends in economic well-being. For example, for India, Dasgupta estimates a decline in what he calls genuine wealth per capita in recent decades. My third observation is that 20 years isn't that long. Teddy knows that, and Meghna knows that, and even I know that. 20 years isn't that long. But since ID was essentially established, the size of the human population has increased by 1.75 billion. Come back in 3 years' time, and that number will be 2 billion in 20 years. This and future demographic growth, because there's plenty of it to come, represents a massive challenge and a massive influence on the planet in which we live. And the effects of demographic trends are often lagged. Very, very important. And I'm not talking about lags of 5 or 10 or even 20 years. I'm talking about lags of 40, 50, 60 years, those kinds of things. So they're quite discernible. Well, finally, and this is an area where lags certainly operate. Finally, of course, there's climate change, global warming and climate change. I was spent 2 or 3 years working on this 5 or 6 years ago. And in my view, it's real. It's really serious, even if you take the IPCC central projections. And climate change has the capacity to screw everything up. Right? I really believe that it does. And in politics and in the policy domain on climate change, what we have is what we would expect: avoidance, denial, blabber. Okay, so Teddy, I think the word crisis may actually be a misnomer. In the coming decades, we may not face the end of the world, but we may well face the end of the world as we have been lucky enough to know it hitherto. Okay, so enough of this pessimism. Enough of this pessimism. What we need is a tonic. What we need is a bracer. And in that context, I can think of no one better to give it than me. You're welcome.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Stuart. I must just say that it's interesting to see Stuart being pro-director. When the pro-directorship was first established, I went around saying I wanted to be elected the anti-director of LSE, but I don't think that is... Anyway, I just want to say one thing, which is about all I will be able to say on what Tim said towards the end. I think, you know, optimists think the world will come to an end. Pessimists think it'll go on like this forever, and I'm a pessimist. Anyway, so coming back to the, you know, what happened all those many years ago, and what happened was we had a director called Dr. I.G. Patel, whom some of you may remember, sort of about 4 directors ago, and he had a distinguished career in India and in international circles. He was at IMF, UNDP, Reserve Bank of India, Ministry of Finance India, and so on. And he thought towards the end of his tenure that LSE ought to be teaching development studies. Hence, a committee was appointed, chaired by Nick Stern. And the committee finally said, yes, we will have a development, we'll study development studies. A new thing called an institute was going to be set up, which is not a department. Because normally, LSE only had departments. One of the first institutes to be set up. And that because LSE had no money in those days, we're not going to spend any extra money on setting up this thing. And therefore, appointments would be internal. And so a man called Peter Loizos, whom some of you may know, reader in anthropology at that time, was appointed the first director of development studies. And within a week, he resigned. He decided that this was not a job he could do, that he wanted to write articles, do his research, you know, have a family life. And so I was summoned by A.G. Patel on various grounds that we both are from the same town in Gujarat, etc. and I was made an offer which I was told I could not refuse, which was that I was to run this new institute at no extra pay and with no reduction of my normal workload as a professor of economics. So I was entirely free for the school. But that was fun. I was young in those days, and I thought I could do anything. So we started in the top of Columbia House, some of you may know. And this is me and Drusilla to begin with. And then we advertised a post, a program director, and what ho, that was John Harris. And John and I had a year to plan courses and do all sorts of interesting things before students were to arrive in 1991. And it was a very interesting prospect at that time, because capitalism may be in trouble right now, but socialism collapsed in 1991. And for me, having grown up in India and elsewhere, and these things happen, this is a technological change. I'll have to shut it off. Can't talk now. Okay, they'll probably call again, so I better switch off my phone. They always do. Okay. No, I think for me, having grown up in India and sort of been a lot of time on the left, the prospect of the USSR collapsing was never, ever, ever on the radar. We were all brought up to think with Lenin that capitalism was in this terminal crisis and it was going to collapse. And I know many, many people who thought it would happen before their life ended. I at least was lucky enough to realize when I was only 50 that was not going to happen in my lifetime. Capitalism was not going to collapse. The alternative had collapsed. And it's hard to understand the profound change of that, because development was born in an anti-capitalist subject. It was profoundly anti-capitalist. And it had absolutely no faith in the market. It had no faith in any of the capital. And people like Paul Baran had long ago warned us that any developing country taking the capitalist path would never ever develop, because monopoly capitalism will not let the third world develop. Wow. Anyway, I at that time, since USSR had collapsed, tried to solve my confusion, went back to, of course, Marx. Abandoned Lenin and go read Marx was my connection. And so I concluded that basically you rethink and you think, no, capitalism is the only game left in town. And while it can be played in a variety of ways, there is no alternative after that. You know, okay, there is North Korea, but I, more than that. Deng Xiaoping had seen the light 13 years before I did, but then he's a clever man. When we were devising the course, I remember John Harris and I, we had a much more positive feeling for what was going on in the outside world, and that there was dynamism left in capitalism, even at that stage. Of course, globalization was just, as it were, hitting at that time. And for me personally, I was also involved in the UNDP, in the human development sort of project. I was there at the beginning with Amartya Sen and Mahbubul Haq. And human development, the whole human development concept, which was born in the late 80s when the Latin American debt crisis and all that, was basically a reconciliation of the dynamics of capitalism and the exigencies of progressive left of center thinking. I mean, you know, this is, I say that because without naming any names, the people who did it were all Stalinists to the last man, who were all rapidly converting to something else. But this was the spirit was that somehow certain alternatives had collapsed, and some other, and we had to explore. Explore this restricted possibility that there was capitalism, capitalism, and capitalism in any color you choose, but there was nothing else around. And I know people probably will disagree with me, but then, you know, we can talk about that. So I think what happened was that we started with a different kind of philosophy than many other development studies departments. But we also start, and this is my one contribution to Destin, that I insisted that no staff of Destin would be paid out of any consultancy contracts that Destin had got. I said, nothing doing. Every staff member was going to be paid a proper salary, going to teach, and any consultancy incomes we ever had nothing to do with staff salary. I mean, they may get some more money, but it's not part of the core salary. And at that time, there were very few development studies departments in the country which subsisted entirely from that kind of full salary position. And then, of course, as always happens, if you're not careful, we grew. We grew kind of wildly. I remember when James Putzel arrived as a temporary lecturer, and there was a big street party at LSE. I think partly, or maybe the first anniversary of my getting my peerage. And I grabbed Christine Chalice and said, give this man a permanent job. And she said, done. And that's how we made your job permanent. I don't know if you remember this or not. But it was... He's still here, is all I can say. Some temporary job. Anyway, we didn't have the heart to interview him. I think we had 20 students in our first batch, 15 full time and 5 part time. But also, Destin always charged full fee. We never ever had any subsidy, and this was Destin became a profit center early on in the school. Now I think what one has to say, what has happened to development studies since then, what happened to the world since then, is that the kind of stability that the Cold War gave to the world, we did not know. We didn't even appreciate how amazingly stable the world was until 1991. And, you know, that there's stability in ideological divisions and so on. This notion of failed state was not there because all failed states were properly kept in control by the two boss powers. And since then, since 1991, one of the most remarkable things has been the breakdown of the solidity of the nation state. But also, development agenda of any development studies has been enriched beyond belief, because at that time we were still in more or less narrowly economic issues like human rights or gender issues and sort of thing about governance and transparency and accountability. None of them were there. We had at LSE the Center for the Study of Global Governance, which was something else I was doing at the same time. And I think I can more or less say, without too much contradiction, that I invented the word global governance. That's another story. But you know, all those issues were not there in development, because development until then was a very state-centered subject, and was a very macro subject. The nation-state had to advance, and therefore, in the kind of wealth of nations, you know, 20th century fashion, how would the GDP grow and things like that. Then it reverted itself and became much more bottom-oriented. The development was really about quality of life of a number of people, how secure they were their rights guaranteed, were their livelihoods guaranteed, how you're going to devise strategies for the poor to get out of poverty, were they always going to be top-down strategies or were they going to be bottom-up strategies. Before 1991, people believed redistribution will solve all problems. You know, all you had to do, abolish capitalism, get socialism, redistribute, and voila, poverty has disappeared. We no longer believe that. And so I think the interesting, I don't think there's a crisis in development studies at all. I think there's enormous enrichment, because we went on pretending in the old days that life was very simple and problems were soluble. And I think both of those things are wrong. Life is extremely complex. And most problems are not soluble. And if you solve a problem, I used to have this slogan, every solution creates its own problems. And every problem may have a solution, but every solution creates its own problems. And that, you know, again, go back to Marx and Engels. And the idea that the world is a dynamic, disequilibrium, crisis-ridden system, normally, has to be the vision of development studies. But I just say one or two optimistic things, and then I'll shut up. Where is the world right now? The center of economic gravity has shifted from the so-called north to the so-called south. And nobody in 1991 would have given you a penny for the idea that India is growing disappointingly at 7.5% this year. You know, there are agonized debates in India. Why only 7.5%? Nobody would have thought that, for example, in 1997, when the Asian crisis occurred and South Korean economy was in trouble, Scotland was worried because Scottish jobs depended upon South Korean investment. Nobody would have thought that India would be the second largest investor in the UK and that Ratan Tata is the largest manufacturing employer. You know, that is a great power of globalization. That is a great power of, as it were, my kind of blind belief, I can't call it theory, that eventually the world was shifting and capitalism had amazing energy left inside it and it was going to transform the world, and transform the world it has. And what we are going through right now, as Tim was saying, is another profound transformation. People should talk about emerging economies. You should only talk about emerging economies if you talk about submerging economies. You know, and all of Europe is submerged. I mean, forget about Europe for the next 25 years. Growth is not going to happen there. It may happen in the United States. Not going to happen in Europe. I can get into that. All the energetic growing areas are where we thought in 1960s growth was never going to happen. Because Paul Baran had told us that. Brazil and China and India and Indonesia. That is a great sort of issue that we ought to be able to face up to. Yes, there are problems. Yes, there are failed states and human rights violations and all those sort of things. We heard about that yesterday from Alex Duval in a very interesting way. But the really positive thing is 1.7 billion people are being born. Somebody has hope about the future. That's why parents are having children, because they have hope. They don't have children if they're in despair. And I think the world is better off right now than it was 50 years ago, in 60 years ago, 1945. Even with the flawed GDP numbers, it's richer. And I think the interesting thing is, how has capitalism done this amazing second or third or fourth transformation in its lifetime? The things we thought were impossible 50 years ago. I mean, recall Henry Kissinger said in 1965 that if China and India could feed themselves, the world would not have any problems. I mean, he was wrong. China and India can feed themselves, the world still has problems. But that was what people thought. And within my lifetime, it has happened. That the world has been transformed. And I don't think there is any North and South anymore. I don't think there's any West or East anymore. There are fast-growing countries and not fast-growing countries, and the location is not predictable from any model that was available to us in the first 50 years after the war. And that, I think, will continue to be the challenge to development studies. That the transformations which are wrought back by the energy of capitalism, the innovativeness of capitalism, in the middle of all the crises. I mean, nobody should ever think that crises are not part of capitalism. Crises are a way capitalism renews itself. And if you don't have crisis, you don't have capitalism. So whenever there's a crisis, rejoice, because you're at the threshold of another great transformation. Anyway, I don't have to worry about this because I don't have to write PhDs. You all have to do, and you have to go to conferences and listen to these things. But remember, whenever there's a crisis, there's hope. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Stuart, Magnad, and Tim. And thank you to all of you for coming to this conference on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of our department. I'm Jean-Paul Faguet. I'm a reader in the department. And I'm honored to have the presence and to share a stage in a small way with scholars of the stature of Jennifer Widener and Peter Evans. Peter will go first, so I'll introduce him first. He's a professor of sociology at University of California, Berkeley, and the Eliaser Professor of International Studies. Alumni of our department know his work very well. He's the author, amongst many other articles and books, of Embedded Autonomy, States and Industrial Transformation, a study of the role of the state in industrial transformation in South Korea, India, and Brazil. Jennifer Widener is Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University and also Director of the Bope Center for Peace and Justice and also the Woodrow Wilson School Program on Institutions for Successful Societies and author of many books and journal papers also, most recently, Building the Rule of Law, a study of courts and law in Africa and developing countries. We've asked you to do presentations of about 25 minutes each in view of running a little bit late. If we can try to keep it maybe a bit more towards 20, that will leave us plenty of time for questions afterwards. And I would ask you to hold all questions for the Q&A to give us a lot of time for discussion. So, Peter, thank you very much.
Is that mic picking up? Is that good? Okay. And then I need to... So it's a great pleasure to be here for the 20th anniversary celebration, a privilege to be able to participate in celebrating what I think is arguably the world's premier producer of sophisticated development practitioners, of world-renowned development scholars, and of course, most important, of new research and ideas on development. It's also a great pleasure to be here among so many old friends and to have a chance to catch up on people that I haven't seen for a long time. I'm going to start with an aspiration and a confession. First, the aspiration, and that is I want to invoke an old friend and, to my mind, one of the most creative of development scholars, and that is Albert Hirschman. I think that Albert's vision of what the study of development is about is particularly appropriate to this topic and to this moment in history. Albert was never a Pollyanna. He was always a brutally realistic individual, but he was also someone who never gave up, and he studied Latin America in its sort of darkest hours. He never gave up his idea of the passion for the possible, never gave up the idea that what we were about was not just analyzing problems, but also looking for possibilities. So my aspiration would be to be able to, in some way at least, keep this orientation in our current discussions. Now, my confession is that I am a PowerPoint primitive. That is to say, I have way too many words on each of the slides, which will soon flow by you. And you probably are going to have to just sort of squint and move on and not worry about it too much. But I haven't managed to surmount my primitiveness, and you'll just have to live with it. I did promise Teddy Brett that I would be brief and leave room for discussion, and so I will try to do that. Okay, we will start with three quick theorems on development. We'll then move on to why deepening democracy is essential for 21st century development. We'll then talk a bit about the perplexities of development in a world dominated by neoliberalism. And then I will look at a comparison of two countries, Brazil and South Africa, which I think illustrate the conundrums of democratic practice as well as the importance of variations in democratic practice for developmental results. And I will come up with that at the end with a positive proposition, which I have called the Heller thesis in honor of Patrick Heller, who basically put it together, and is, of course, like most theses, one with some crucial caveats. Okay. My three quick theorems. First of all, and I don't think anyone will disagree with this one, is that state capacity is essential to development. The second one, which it'll be interesting to see whether there's disagreement, is that a Sennian conception of development now properly dominates over traditional accumulation fetishism. Okay? That is to say, the expansion of human capabilities is both the measure of development and also the key means of development. And then finally, my theorem is that focusing on development as Sennian capability expansion makes deepening democracy more clearly crucial to the effectiveness and efficiency of the state. Now, I'm sure, that is to say, I would be surprised and disappointed if there weren't disagreement with one more or perhaps all of these theorems, but at least you sort of know where I'm starting out from. Okay, we'll start with this political side of Sen's capability approach. The point is that as long as when you move from one good thing to an expansion of a variety of things, human capabilities, it is no longer possible to technocratically define the goals of development. And therefore, simply defining what you are about in terms of development requires deeply institutionalized forms of democratic deliberation. This, in turn, I would argue, although Sen does not stress it, implies a process of political contestation. It implies a process of political contestation institutionalized in such a way as to allow people to focus on collective goals, and, very importantly, institutionalized in such a way as to protect the ability of disprivileged groups to defend their own vision of collective goals. I would add to this that deepening democracy is not only important in a Sennian version of development to defining goals, but also essential to implementation. And I'll just throw out these two specifications of the ways in which deepening democracy is essential to implementation. First of all, you can't get information about what people want, what their goals are, without some kind of process of democratic deliberation. And consequently, democratic deliberation is essential for increasing the returns on public and social investments. Secondly, any kind of capability-oriented development is a process of co-production. And I was very pleased when Eleanor Ostrom won the Nobel Prize to underline that point. And so if you want co-production, you have to have the active engagement of society. And this, in turn, requires some kind of process of democratic engagement. Finally, of course, democratic deliberation is a way of increasing transparency and accountability. It may increase perceptions, or it may increase awareness of corruption, but it increases transparency and accountability, and therefore reduces corruption and increases the resources available for a democratic developmental state. Okay, so. Point is, if you believe that Sennian development dominates over accumulation fetishism, then you have to see democratic deliberation as essential to the effectiveness of the state. Okay, and this brings us to our second topic, which is the perplexities of democracy in a world dominated by global neoliberal capitalism. Now, neoliberalism, in my view, has played an important positive role in terms of spreading democracy around the world. True to its classic liberal political roots, neoliberalism has made democracy an important ideological political goal for all countries, a standard for participation in the international community, etc. Unfortunately, the version of democracy which neoliberalism supports, encourages, nurtures, and fosters is simply electoral competitive transfers of power. Neoliberalism does not support democracy as depending upon the collective contestation of economic rules and the allocation of resources by subordinate groups. To the contrary, it finds that something of an anathema. Furthermore, as an ideologically aggressive kind of capitalism, neoliberalism systematically undercuts the legitimacy of state action. Therefore, if state capacity is essential to developmental success, untrammeled global neoliberalism facilitates the emergence of democratic states, but simultaneously robs them of the capacity to respond to the demands of their constituencies, thereby delegitimating not only the state, but eventually democracy as well. So neoliberalism, I would argue, has a deeply ambivalent relationship to democracy. That means that the version of democratic politics supported by neoliberal global capitalism is in fundamental contradiction to the democratic politics required for successful sentient development. However, we should not let that discourage us. We should continue in the spirit of Albert Hirschman, because these results are not determined inevitability. They're always subject to agency. Okay? Therefore, the task, as I see it, if we're interested in development, which requires a deep version of democracy, the task is to figure out how it is possible to move in the direction of those deep versions of democracy that are necessary, despite the external pressures from global neoliberalism. Okay, so what I'm going to do is to use as an example of the possible variations here, an illustration of South Africa and Brazil. Okay, now South Africa and Brazil are interesting cases. They are both countries which have democratized over the course of the last generation. They're both countries that democratized in the context of deeply ingrained inequalities, both social and economic. And for my purposes, they are interesting because while the political leaderships of both countries share progressive goals, they have diverged significantly over the course of the last two decades. Okay? And we can see this on various kinds of dimensions and indicators. Here's infant mortality, where we see Brazil significant improvements, in South Africa some declines. Here we have net primary school enrollment, where we see essentially the same thing. And perhaps most important, if we look at data on inequality, back when I started studying Brazil, Brazil considered itself to be the world champion of inequality. South Africa, of course, was always highly unequal. But if we look at Brazil and South Africa today, the divergence between the two countries in terms of inequality is dramatic. I mean, for those of you who spend a lot of time looking at Gini indexes around the world, which I assume all international development students do, for those of you who spend lots of time looking at Gini indexes around the world, you will realize that the difference between Brazil having reached 0.53, which may seem high, but relative to its past is a significant decline. And South Africa, sadly, have moving from the high 50s to the mid 60s in terms of a Gini index. That creates a gap to them which is like the gap between the Nordics and the Anglo countries, like the gap between China, what it used to be, and China, what it is today, et cetera. It's a monster gap. Okay. So how do we explain this? Well, different rates of growth, probably not. The two countries, neither one of them grew very well in the 80s and 90s, better later on, but essentially similar rates of growth. How about state capacity? Probably not. Those who know South Africa, I think, would agree South Africa, among countries of the global south, starts out with relatively high state capacity. Still today probably has higher state capacity than most countries in the global south. Okay, AIDS perhaps explains it. Well, in fact, I would argue that AIDS and the differential impact of AIDS in the two countries is completely endogenous to the politics of the two countries. And, you know, we could argue about that as well. So that takes me to my positive thesis, which is the differential democratic deepening thesis. Okay, and this, as I say, is based on work that Patrick Heller's been doing over the last, I don't know, 6-7 years, working on both South Africa and Brazil. And Heller focuses on a very particular feature of democratic deepening, which is the relationship between civil society and the state as mediated by the character of political society. Okay? And we can come back to thinking about exactly what we mean by political and civil society, etc. So, what does Heller argue? Heller argues that in these countries, despite a shared commitment to democracy in general, in these countries there has been, over the course of the last 20 years, a divergence in the degree to which civil society is able to effectively engage the state. And Heller argues that in South Africa we have found a situation in which civil society organizations have been estranged from political society in the sense of political parties and the state itself, that old Mandani's old decentralized despotism has continued in rural constituencies, and that even in urban areas, subaltern civil society, especially the urban poor, has been more or less sidelined from politics. Okay, an estrangement, a division between civil society and the state. In contrast, in Brazil, surprising if one thought of Brazil in the 70s or 80s, surprisingly in Brazil, a relatively autonomous civil society has emerged. There are clear instances of the capacity of civil society, including subaltern groups, to project itself into the state to shape policy, and we have the institutionalization of a wide range of participatory structures which strengthen local democratic government. Okay, so that is the thesis. Now let's move on to the obvious caveats. Okay, first, of course, the ability to create this kind of deepened democracy depends upon a certain context. And obviously it depends upon the existence of minimal state resources and state capacity to begin with. It also depends upon the adherence to those sort of basic democratic rules of the game that global neoliberalism supports. Okay? So consequently, we would not expect the Heller thesis to be an immediately applicable thesis to poor, crisis-ridden states from Somalia to Haiti, or to completely undemocratic regimes from North Korea to Saudi Arabia, since the basic context is lacking. However, what I would argue is that even in these regimes, which are a long way from being able to worry about democratic deepening, even in these regimes, thinking about democracy in this way, thinking about democracy in terms of the relationship between civil society, political society, and the state, instead of being transfixed by the idea that the institutionalization of electoral competition is the goal, and once you've gotten there, then you have the democratic part of the development equation solved. I think that thinking about democracy in this relational way is very important, even if you're a, you know, potential democratic advocate in Saudi Arabia who obviously has a long, long way to go before you're going to think about deepening. How you envisage the ultimate goal, I think, makes a big difference, even if that goal is a long way away. And I would argue that this Heller thesis does have a very important range of states to which it is applicable and is important in the immediate context. And we would include, or at least I would include, middle-income countries in Latin America, perhaps Egypt. And the discussion yesterday was quite interesting in that regard. Certainly India, and certainly a large range of countries in East and Southeast Asia. Okay, second caveat. There is still, I would argue, and with despite the apparent dynamism of global capitalism, I would essentially agree with Tim Dyson here that there is a still basic contradiction between the way in which the political economy of global neoliberal capitalism works and the possibilities for the sustainable satisfaction of the needs of ordinary citizens. I think that contradiction is intensified, and obviously, even the most effective political innovations at the national level come up against, at some point, the limitations created by that context of global capitalism. Brazil can institute a Bolsa Família, but it still has brutally high interest rates, which strangle its ability to grow. Okay. Now, the third obvious candidate caveat here is that, obviously, the Heller thesis, as I've presented it, is not a clear how-to-do-it kind of set of practical policy strategies. And for those of you who are irritated and disappointed by that lack, I am looking, you can look to solace for the next presentation by Jennifer Widener, which at least will move us in that direction. However, despite all these caveats, I would argue that this way of looking at democracy, this focusing on democracy as a relationship between civil society and the state, a relationship which is mediated through the character of political society, this perspective which redirects our attention from the institutionalization of electoral democracy to trying to figure out ways for the effective engagement of civil society with the state remains an extremely important and an extremely valuable orienting focus. Okay? So, this perspective, I would argue, is one that results in real changes in terms of the lives of ordinary citizens. This kind of political change can result in real changes, not only in terms of the numbers, which I just threw up on the screen there relative to Brazil and South Africa, but also in terms of the subjective perceptions of citizens of themselves, their sense of recognition, identity, etc. Obviously, if you take my previous argument seriously and buy that, without figuring out ways for more effective democratic processes, it's not possible to build a developmental state in the sense of a capability-enhancing state. If we believe that a capability-enhancing state is the sine qua non of increased well-being, therefore, this question of democratic practices is essential in terms of not just politics, it's essential in terms of development. And finally, of course, despite the pressure from global neoliberal capitalism, there is no structural logic which prevents these variations in democratic practices. It may limit the extent to which they can deliver, but I would argue that changing democratic practices at the national level is the first step toward thinking about how to transform the structural restraints at the level of the global political economy. And so I would argue this perspective does indeed sort of move in the direction of looking for the passion for the possible. It does indeed help us to at least move towards satisfying our Hirschmanian aspirations. Thank you very much.
So can everybody hear me? I'll try to stand a little close to this. Thank you very much for inviting me here today, and thank you, John Paul, for an overly generous introduction. I'm in my period of chronic doubt about all academic theory right now, so it's always very reassuring to hear that somebody got something out of something I wrote. Teddy Brett yesterday encouraged all of us to think about the reformers in Egypt, the Arab Spring generally, and I tried to take that quite seriously. I actually reconfigured what I was going to say a bit, and I would like to proceed with that today. Peter also said, would you talk a little bit about the practitioner side? So I'm going to play the practitioner as well. So what I'd like to do is sketch five ways democracy and institutional capacity interact, five common challenges that the reformers of the Arab Spring face, plus some ideas that reformers in other parts of the world have brought to bear to address these challenges. Elections, as we all know, in the context of very limited institutional capacity, can kindle or rekindle conflict, creating a downward spiral that I would call a trap, a downward spiral into violence. Violence brings weakening institutional capacity. Jack Snyder, Paul Collier, plenty of other people have noted this phenomenon. Whether to build accountable government or to facilitate peaceful transitions or successions, elections are obviously helpful. But they're only helpful if those underlying conditions that support them are more or less in place, just as markets only enhance the efficient use of resources if the conditions for competitiveness are truly there, and they often aren't. So the problem is the transition, how to get from here to there, how to get to a place where those conditions are more secure. So what I want to do is, in these five contributions, pick apart the problem, sketch what some of these reformers are doing, and emphasize some politician-friendly approaches. I won't do that universally. I have some politician-proofing solutions in there, too. But I think, as Alex did yesterday, I'm somewhat sympathetic with the positions of reformers when they come to power, and want to see if we can come up with some solutions that are incentive compatible, as our economist friends would say. In making these observations, I'm going to draw on some case studies from a program that I run at Princeton University called Innovations for Successful Societies. The research team there chronicles the efforts of reform leaders in many parts of the world, the efforts to manage very significant governance challenges that arise from insecurity, from geographic remoteness, and from limited resources. We try to find strategies for escaping a variety of governance traps. That's the core mission of the program. The program's public face is a website where all of the cases are available, along with a lot of the interviews. I think right now there are about 54 cases up there and about 22 more in the pipeline, so I invite you to use those. So let me talk about the first problem, the politicization trap, and I'm going to give a little bit more time to this problem than to some of the others. What is this trap? New leaders come into office facing extremely high expectations. This would be true of the ANC in South Africa, obviously true of the Arab Spring reformers today. They come into power with very high expectations, and they very rapidly find they can't get government to do their bidding. They can't get the civil servants to deliver what it was that people said that they wanted. It's very sluggish. And the leader's first thought is almost inevitably, I better appoint some political stalwarts, some of my trusted political allies or cadres, to positions in the civil service to get it moving so that we're actually delivering what people wanted. And that's a an understandable response. We see it in all parts of the world, not just the countries that I think are at the focus of many of our remarks today. We see it everywhere. But the step has a number of very serious consequences. First, it leads people inside government and outside government to think that government jobs are really a form of patronage. And it sends the signal that to the victor go the spoils, even if that wasn't the leader's intention. And I think here a bit of the South African case. I think the government of Jacob Zuma is struggling with this right now. How do you get the government apparatus to deliver the services that people want? Well, do you install more people from the ANC in the lower levels of the civil service, in positions that traditionally would have been recruited in according to civil service rules? But the risk of this is that it does create a sense that positions are patronage posts. Political competition then develops a much sharper edge. It becomes a competition for the spoils of office. And we see a form of that, obviously, in Kenya. It's our turn to eat phenomenon has an ethnic edge there, doesn't always have an ethnic edge. We see it in Bangladesh, where the political parties have penetrated almost all aspects of government and of informal associations. Within short order, the kinds of people attracted to senior government jobs or even mid-level government jobs are those inclined to use the office as a source of rents. So we see declining capacity following from that, and often the emergence of what Robert Wade has called a market for public office, that is, positions are for sale, there's quite a bit of shuffling in the civil service. People don't stay in their positions very long because the broker behind the scenes is selling the job to somebody else or selling the transfer to somebody else. They're only on the job for about 6 months. You can't run a reform program. You can't get an organization to work if all your personnel are moving all the time. So performance deteriorates further. And I think this triggers this downward spiral. And we've seen this a bit in Bangladesh, in Kenya, in Albania. And in all of these places, there are reformers trying to make a difference, but they're stuck in this right now. And it's much harder to escape this once you're stuck in it than it is to try to solve the problem before you get into it. So I think we need a plea for sympathy for these leaders. They face a real challenge. Escape is hard because you have to tell some of the people who have been your supporters that they're not allowed to have these jobs. So you're going to impose some losses on the people who support you. Evasion is much easier. So what I would tell the Arab reformers is look at some of the efforts around the world to try to avoid getting into this situation in the first place. First, I think that often it's a misdiagnosis of the problem. The feeling is you need more political direction. I'm not sure that's true. Increasingly, as we go around the world and look at reformers' actions in now over 40 countries, you find the real problem is that the mid-level public managers don't get down in the weeds. They don't see where the delivery is breaking down. Therefore, they don't do anything about it. So the key to boosting performance is not to install your political friends, but rather to actually get the mid-level managers and the senior managers to trace the delivery chain, figure out where it's breaking down, and find some solutions to that problem. We've seen a number of reformers do that very successfully lately, including in South Africa, where they turned around the provision of identity documents in home affairs, in Jordan much earlier, exactly the same thing. Where the mid-level managers are willing to get out there and spot the problems, we see some success in delivering at least the simpler things that government produces. The second thing I would say is limit the number of goals. It's very hard with limited resources and limited managerial skill to try to manage delivery of civil services off of, over a wide span of ministries. very few goals, much more limited number of ministries is helpful. Create short-term targets. The less a government has going for it, the less capacity, the greater the need, I think, for short-term targets. 100-day targets have been suggested by some. The rapid results programs that we're seeing in some areas are, I think, quite helpful. I think here in Britain, this is the deliverology that Michael Barber was talking about in the Blair administration. But I think that has a lot of utility in many parts of the world. And finally, getting the word out to voters that you're actually making an improvement in these services is terribly important. Communicating, terribly important. And it's something that many new governments can't do well because they haven't figured out how to construct their own center of government offices, their own cabinet offices effectively. So I think this is a number one point where you get interaction between elections and state capacity. The second is what I would call an expectations trap. We talked yesterday briefly about patronage, and I think the assumption behind a lot of the remarks was that this is a top-down phenomenon, that leaders are trying to buy the currency of support. They're trying to buy loyalty in elections. But I think that there's a bottom-up dimension to this as well. What do people want? Well, very often, these are private benefits. They're the kinds of things that we would associate with as the currency of patronage. The demand for private benefits is often much, much greater than the demand for public goods. So to compete for favor, the politicians play that game. Well, it may be possible to avoid the consequent distrust that comes with that by trying to shape expectations of the public. Whatever one may think of some of the of what's going on in Rwanda these days, I think there's a very interesting experiment afoot in the Imihigo movement. This is a very clear effort to try to shift public expectations in the direction of public goods. And for those of you who don't know this experiment, the Kagame government has directed communities to get together with their politicians, their administrations at the local level, and decide what it is that they want to accomplish, to set some goals, to put that in a contract form, and then that contract or delivery on that contract is monitored, and people are rated, the mayors are rated, and those who don't perform well, and they're not elected in this system yet, are removed. But it's you could look at this as a way to get accountability of officials at the local level, but it's also very clearly an effort to try to change the way people at the local level are thinking about what it is that they want out of government to rebuild this notion of contract. Antonos Mokas in Bogota, I think, has been trying some similar kinds of efforts. He's been trying to shape perceptions in ways that I think are more conducive to the provision of public goods rather than patronage goods. Very interesting experiments there, and later on we might talk a little bit about this. I don't know what the people who are giving papers on cities are going to say, but I think this is a much easier thing to do in an urban environment than it is in a rural environment. And the interesting thing about Rwanda is that it's a largely rural effort. A challenge for all the political scientists in the room is also to figure out a way to make politicians' contributions to public goods provision individually identifiable. This is one of the problems of providing public goods. You can't associate a particular politician with an outcome that benefits everybody. It's hard to figure out what that politician's contribution to that has been. So if we can find a way to break it down, to measure it, and to give people credit, it might ease the situation. It's a demand for creativity here. A third problem, a point of interaction, I think comes early in the design of new political systems, just in the course of peace settlements or the development of new constitutions. And that is, in these settings, people are trying to broker grand compromises that draw different factions in. But they rarely look at the coherence of the terms within the Constitution, the coherence among chapters. And some significant incentive problems can arise from this. And I'm going to give the example of Papua New Guinea and the way in which the allocation of autonomy to local areas has interacted with the political system there. So as you know, there was major conflict in Bougainville. There was an effort to provide significant autonomy to local areas. Not all were quite capable of delivering services, but the same rules applied everywhere. Well, the delegation of authority for providing services meant that the people at the local level got the credit for delivering the services, and the parliamentarians at the top could get no credit for this. The politicians at the local level used their contributions as a springboard into national politics, and they competed successfully with some of the sitting MPs for their positions. The parliamentarians then predictably cut off the funding to a lot of the local areas, hoping that they could strangle the local politicians and reduce competition. A case where people didn't pay close enough attention to the alignment of incentives. I think we see problems like that in almost all of the newer constitutions. It's a plea for better constitution drafting, but also some very creative thinking about what it is that you can what kinds of powers you can reserve to the national parliament to ensure that parliamentarians have something, some basis on which to compete, something that they can get credit for doing that is consistent with better government performance. I should say constituency development funds are possibly one answer to this, but I'm not sure that that's successful. So we ought to be thinking, again, creatively about this one. The fourth point I want to make is a politician-proofing example. There are certain temptations at election time, certain highly sensitive institutions, where the capture of these institutions just before the election can bring special electoral advantage. For a long time, those institutions, the main institution was the central bank. If you could penetrate the central bank, you could get some cash, pass it out in the back of a pickup truck. That created political business cycles later on. We saw that in Kenya a number of years ago. We've seen it in plenty of other countries. But the world has gotten kind of wise to this one, and I think central bank independence is stronger now than it used to be. It's much harder to manipulate a central bank than for this kind of purpose. But then, to use the example of Kenya again, land registries have become a big target, and I would say are equally sensitive in most parts of the world. Where people depend upon land for food and for security, land becomes a highly sensitive and highly coveted object. And where some of the worst violence surrounding elections appears is where politicians have managed to get into the land registries to manipulate the issue of deeds. I would think that land registries ought to be on the horizon as a critical institution that merits some special protection, just as central banks have been. There are various ways you can do this. Sometimes these are external agencies of restraint, international associations that limit and monitor, observe, and limit what kinds of involvement politicians have. But you can imagine inclusive local oversight boards performing much the same function. We've put party representatives on these boards, civil society representatives on these boards to actually oversee the behavior of the land registries. I don't have any hard examples of that kind of approach. It's often associated more with some other kinds of public management styles I'll talk about in a minute, but I think it's potentially quite useful. Customs ports are another place where you can scarf up a lot of patronage resources, and I think many countries are now actually farming out the operation of these to private actors for this reason. And finally, the fifth point. I think that in some kinds of social structures, you get a particular kind of violence emerging from electoral competition. Where you have segmentary systems, where there has been, in the fairly recent past, the institution of the feud, elections can become quite serious flashpoints. And here I want to draw on, we think of Somalia in this connection. I think Libya potentially is also in this, Yemen as well. But I want to draw an example from Egypt. Obviously hard to do case studies in Egypt. My research team was working there just before the Arab Spring broke out. And we profiled some of the work of a governor in an area called Kenna. And Kenna had long been highly insecure, significant violence and disaffection. And a man named Adel Labib was brought in as governor, and hasn't been terribly popular, or wasn't terribly popular when he was moved elsewhere, but he was very popular in this community. And one of the ways in which he tried to manage clan tensions and other kinds of tensions was to practice strict equality in the allocation of resources and to make this highly transparent. So he created transparent bank accounts for each community and would show each community the flow of money into those and how they compare to others. I think in societies where you're fairly close to that history of blood feud as a regulation, as a way to regulate conflict, and to the kinds of behaviors that come along with that, this system of strict equality and transparent bank accounts is a highly useful innovation. And I hope that the leaders of the Arab Spring in Egypt don't lose the know-how that this governor built up. I don't know how the governors of the former government are faring these days, but I hope that social capital or that intellectual capital has not completely disappeared. My last remark in concluding is to offer an observation that I think is very important. Rolf Meyer in South Africa and I were talking about this, said, you know, a fear that what we're losing in South Africa is the notion of a loyal opposition. Or what we haven't ever had was perhaps the notion of a loyal opposition, although I think the ANC in some senses was. How do you go about building a loyal opposition? This is something that's relevant for the United States these days, too. We all need to be thinking about how you build a loyal opposition. And I think for the leaders of the Arab Spring, I would try to set a tone very early and be very, very inclusive. This is the moment for inclusiveness. This is the moment for building collaboration across political parties, across people of different kinds of religious persuasions, joint boards, joint social events. It is also a period where I think very high degrees of transparency in all things are not necessarily good. There need to be some opportunities for people to compromise without losing face. And sometimes that means closing the doors to publicly televised hearings, as was done in South Africa after some initial violence when the proceedings of the constitutional negotiations were fully open, violence ensued, closed them partly, and it was easier to get compromise. And finally, I would say it's important to get politicians engaged in collaborative thinking about longer term issues. So I would take the people in the wings from all parties and try to put them on commissions to focus on this, perhaps even travel together to try to build this sense of a loyal opposition. Can make some more remarks later on and draw on a number of examples, but I know we're short time, so I will leave it there. I hope I've delivered on the promise of Hirschman. Albert Hirschman, one of his efforts was to spend a lot of time in Colombia, driving around looking at what reformers were doing, and in a sense, he has been our inspiration as well.
Who would like to? Yes, James first.
Peter and Jennifer, brilliant presentations both, as I would have expected. But Peter, I want to put a question to each of you. Peter, I remember a time when those who believed and pursued the practice of socialism were confronted with the real problems it had, both in economic terms and in rights terms. And they said, but that's not really socialism. What we see in the world is not really socialism. And I think there's a problem in the way you're approaching this. I mean, you, like I, normatively Democrats, but you want democracy without neoliberalism. But, you know, and those places that are calling themselves democratic today, well, you can say, that's not really the kind of democracy I want. So I think there's a problem in the approach, because democratic consolidation requires a material base. So historical evidence from the OECD countries from the past 60 years in terms of those places that have had sustained accelerated growth experiences indicates that there's something less than what we consider as the set of democratic rules. So there is a material base to democracy that remains important. Processes of accumulation, transformation of agriculture and industry in developing countries is still absolutely necessary to get to the point where you can bring some substance into democracy, and it's that transcendent. What we need, yes, in order to get there is deliberation, like you said, and yes, checks on executive authority. But this is not necessarily what is commonly understood as the package of systematic innovations reforms in politics that go by the name of democracy. And Jennifer, I mean, I think this case study work is very rich, and I think you're taking things forward in a very interesting way. But in many of the countries that you're studying, like those we studied, public sector jobs have been absolutely central to buying peace. It's also been absolutely central to have the powers of rent allocation. Rent allocation is not, and is very difficult to pursue in any kind of developmental way, or even peace-encouraging way, through democratic means. In fact, those usually derail rents. So Rwanda is able to do the Imihigo program, partly because of limited political competition in the system. So these are some of the realities that I think one has to take into account when considering how to get there to a more extensively and substantive democracy that can be based on reducing inequality and improving people's life chances. Yeah?
Sorry. I think we've got one in the back. Elliot?
Yeah. Oh, okay, this is a deliberately provocative question for Peter Evans. I'm not sure I buy the comparison between South Africa and Brazil, or the story, specifically about South Africa, in the sense we have a transfer from an apartheid regime to the post-apartheid regime, and I don't think the story is about civil society. I think it's about the fact that under apartheid South Africa, we can talk about South Africa as a developmental state, for white people, but it's a developmental state, right? And then we transfer to a post-apartheid regime where the focus is much more about political stability than it is about development, right? And that's one of the great stories about development, I think, that we can touch upon more broadly, because this is exactly the problem that we've seen in Africa and India, and certainly in the post-colonial period, is the focus on choosing political stability over structural transformation that's necessary for long-term economic development. In some sense, this is really, to me, more of an issue than what we're talking about than the issue about civil society.
Why don't we take stop it there, and then we'll have another round? Because I think that those are some fairly meaty questions.
Shall I?
Yes, Peter, why don't you go?
Is this going now?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Real democracy versus neoliberalism. I, as I tried to make clear, am not disparaging the kind of democracy that neoliberalism creates and encourages. That is to say, I'm not saying that, you know, elections are not real democracy. I'm saying that elections are not a form of democracy sufficient to produce the kinds of developmental consequences that will sustain democracy. And that if one focuses too much on elections, which is what neoliberal rhetoric and certainly the foreign policy of countries like Britain and the United States, that pressure tends to push local politicians and indeed local civil society organizations, the Global South, to do. If one focuses on elections and assumes that elections are solutions to political problems as opposed to part of a process toward getting to a political set of institutions that actually allow representation and actually allow democratic deliberation to play the developmental role that is essential, that's what I'm arguing against. I'm not trying to disparage the electoral part. Now, material base. When I was a young cad, there was something called modernization theory, which I actually haven't heard about for, I don't know, maybe 20 years. Maybe it's been 20 years since latest it appeared most lately, I think, in China, but soon disappeared there as well. In any case, modernization theory had a very simple proposition, which was actually Seymour Martin Lipset, I think, was one of the most effective opponents of it, which was that you have to get rich first and then you can be democratic. And that was, you know, that was how Seymour Martin Lipset and others were reading history. I think that that's not only wrong, but pernicious. Because I think that if people assume, we're poor, therefore, not only don't we have to be democratic, we can't be democratic. So, you know, that's how it is. We have to develop our material base first. I mean, John Harris, I'm sure, could talk for about 15 or 20 minutes about the material base, more than that, about the material base or lack thereof that one had along with the development of a deliberative kind of very active sort of democracy in Kerala. Kerala's per capita income, I mean, most of the countries we're dealing today are you know, orders of magnitude higher material base than existed in Kerala. I just don't think that one can use the excuse of lack of material base to avoid focusing on questions of democratic institution building, which I'm sure you're not really advocating doing, but in any case. Now, let me make one other point, though, and that is that what I am arguing is not that there is this sort of democratic institution building versus growth. What I'm arguing is that deliberative democracy is, in fact, in the modern world, an essential component of growth. And I know that you'll pull out various, not you necessarily, but that people will pull out various cases and say, you know, Park Chung-hee was no Democrat. Okay, sure, you can pull out cases like that. But for every authoritarian regime that produces higher rates of growth, I can show you two authoritarian regimes that produce total collapse. And so I just don't buy the idea that there is some kind of growth affinity for authoritarian regimes in general, despite the fact that there have you can put out cases. Okay, and that actually gets us back to Elliot's question there as to how we view South Africa. I don't buy the development versus stability kind of dichotomy. I don't buy it because Brazil had lousy growth. South Africa had lousy growth too, but we're not talking about a difference in growth here. We're not talking about a question of one country choosing growth and the other country choosing stability. What we're talking about is two countries that both did less well in the more democratic 90s in terms of growth than they had earlier on, but one country managed, in the context of relatively low growth, to shift resources in such a way as to reduce inequality and to increase the delivery of collective public goods in such a way as to improve the material well-being of the lives of people more effectively. Okay? Now, South Africa made huge efforts to do the same thing. or at least to do the same thing in terms of delivery of collective goods. But they were less effective at it than Brazil. And I think that, I have disagreements with the Heller thesis that we could go into if you're interested, but I think that the Heller thesis is onto something in the sense that if you want to deliver collective goods effectively, you have to have some kind of effective, efficacious, deliberative institutions in order to do it. And that Brazil, for reasons that frankly I still don't understand, seems to have managed to do better in terms of delivering, of constructing those deliberative institutions.
This is to James's question. I think giving public sector jobs to people in these deals is problematical for a whole variety of reasons. I do understand that it's certainly tough to resist that pressure. One could certainly argue that much of the Rwanda conflict was sparked by the allocation of jobs in the Arusha peace declaration. But I think there are a couple of ways you could avoid giving lots of public jobs out in order to buy stability. You do have to explain what you're doing to the public, and I think a lot of these governments aren't terribly good at doing that. We can provide some help there. But much depends upon the opportunity costs as well. There are a number of countries in the kinds that we're talking about today where a government job doesn't actually pay very much. It's really the access to rent collection that it provides that's useful. If you both curtail that possibility of rent collection by changing the way in which fees are collected, and you don't raise the wage very much, it may be much more attractive to stay outside of government. So I think simultaneously restricting the ability to pay to acquire payments for licenses and that sort of thing. At the same time, you keep the wages fairly low initially for that kind of work is one way to make people a little happier about leaving. And the Republic of Georgia did this massive cuts in public employment, replacement of whole staffs of ministries or services, and very little public reaction to that, largely because I think it just didn't pay to stay in. Now, there are plenty of situations where that doesn't work as well, and you have to find other kinds of strategies. It may be that you want to allow one part of government to be the place where you have the patronage hiring, and the other part with core economic services that's protected. And I think that was basically the earlier Indonesia strategy. So you try to protect the core economic operations from this sort of appointment. You free up other areas, and then down the road, you hope that you can address that problem, or that you begin to get public demand for changing that problem. And I think they did get some of that. Now they're grappling with more complicated dimensions of the problem. So I think much depends upon the opportunity costs, whether there are private sector alternatives, what the actual wage rate is at the time, whether you can constrain the ability to use the positions for rents, and whether you can kind of cordon off one section for jobs and keep the other clear.
Good. Can we down here, sorry, John Harris? No? Let's have John. John had his hand up at the very beginning.
Just getting you running around.
Sorry. Can't ignore one of our founding fathers, John
great,
Harris.
Great for exercise, yeah. Well, I said whispered to Tim Dyson before the beginning of this session that I entirely sympathized with his rather pessimistic view of the state of the world at the moment, and I also said that we could count on Peter Evans to present a rather more optimistic kind of vision, using the word optimism in the more orthodox sense than that Meghna Desai suggested earlier. And you didn't disappoint, Peter. You presented a very positive kind of picture, and I too have a great deal of sympathy with. I find what you describe as the Heller thesis, though I think could reasonably be described as the Evans thesis, actually as well. I really find a lot of that very persuasive. But what bothers me about it is what seemed to me to be rather unquestioned sorts of assumptions about the character of civil society in this argument. Civil society is, in the sense in which you and Patrick Heller have defined it, is essentially a middle-class sphere. And it seems to me that, you know, the middle class historically has always had, middle classes have a rather ambiguous kind of relationship with democracy, very supportive of it up to a certain point. If I reflect upon, you know, the nature of civil society in, you know, some parts of the world with which I'm familiar, civil society activism has some very positive kinds of may have very positive kinds of consequences. In the case of India, it's civil society activism which has, to a very important extent, been responsible for the transformation of what were originally directive principles of the Constitution into fundamental economic and social rights. But there's another side to middle class activism in civil society as well. And that's a side which is actually fundamentally undercutting democracy, or actually, I think, bringing into question democratic principles. And I mean, I think we've seen that in the last few days, the last few weeks in India. You and others, I'm sure, will be aware of the movement around this man, Anna Hazare. Okay, now, you know, we may well want to support the cause. Many of us, all of us probably here, would want to support the cause that Hazare espouses. But what about the methods? We might applaud Hazare standing out against corruption, but achieving it by actually, in many ways, non-democratic means. I think there really is a problem in your argument which relates to the nature and character of civil society. May I just pass this quickly to Neera?
To Neera, yes, please. Let's have Neera.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciated your presentation very much, bringing in democracy into the development discourse. I have two very quick points. One is, I do not see civil society in a restricted sense, but I do see it as a very divided space with all kinds of organizations bringing all kinds of projects which then proceed to conflict or to collaborate with each other. If we were to take Hegel and Gramsci seriously, civil society is just a theater of history. It's where people, where groups armed with various projects. So for every Anna Hazare phenomena, there are a number of civil society groups saying, look, there are alternative ways of fighting corruption. Whereas I think this notion of deliberative democracy as contestation is very well taken, we must not also forget that this gives an enormous amount of leeway to the state to practice politics of discrimination and upholding certain groups and kind of neglecting other groups. So it's a very uneven space. And in Brazil, if I'm not mistaken, most research has shown that only those civil society organizations get heard by the powers that be if they are backed by the Workers' Party. You know, other kinds of civil society organizations are by and large sidelined. So we have to see it as an enormously uneven and enormously contestatory space, which is good for democracy because we were all involved in creating alternatives to Anna Hazare's formulation with a number of civil society organizations. And now the Indian Parliament has about four different approaches on offer. So we must not see civil society only in terms of one kind of an event. I don't like to call it a movement, that was stage managed. The second point is, however, probably more germane to your argument. You talked about neoliberalism bringing about a certain notion of democracy and spreading it across the world. But then there was a change of heart after the 1998 economic crisis, arriving at the post-Washington consensus. And in that, the state came to play a large role in delivery of social goods. Now, the problem is that democracy has been reduced in much thinking to delivery of social goods. So you have poverty without equality, and you have capabilities without freedom. So that aspect of democracy, which talks about transforming people into agents of history, has been missed out completely. And the troubling part is that many NGOs, who are one component of this vast realm we call civil society, are today partnering the state. And there is no genuine critique of the state. You cannot critique the state when you're receiving your funds from the state. And finally, the problem with today's civil society activism, as a number of different projects, is that there is no big idea. And that's the sad part of it. Democracy is ensuring midday meals, it's about education, it's about health, all of which is very important. But there is something more important, and if we look to Marx for that, it is enabling people to speak back to a history not of their own making. And this is the mandate of the new neoliberal order.
Shall we take those before we get some more questions?
Nero will remember, perhaps, we were at a conference on civil society about 10 years ago, and in my commentary, I advocated abolishing the word civil society. Obviously, I've sort of been forced to retreat a little bit on that position, because civil society just keeps coming back at me, and I haven't figured out a way around it. But I'm completely sympathetic. My position, in some sense, hasn't changed with both you and John in terms of civil society being this horrible concept. And in fact, one of my small gripes with Patrick Keller is that he's a little bit more of a Habermasian in that respect than I think I am. But the difficulty is, it is, I think, fundamentally important, and I think you both agree, that constituencies have to be able to organize independently of political society, that is to say, independently of people whose primary interests are instrumental political interests, and independently of the state. And they have to be able in some way to engage the state to both formulate their demands and positions and to project those positions onto state actors and political actors. I think we probably agree on that. The question is, how does one take this sort of beast of civil society, which is in fact a deeply divided kind of structure? I mean, you're completely right there. And one way I agree with Patrick is Patrick always emphasizes subaltern civil society and the ability of disprivileged groups to formulate their goals, etc., which is obviously fundamental. So I agree with the uncomfortableness of this concept of civil society, which homogenizes conflicts, class conflicts, various kinds of conflicts of privilege and disprivilege, and is therefore easily sort of slipped through in ways that are you know, sort of deeply offensive in terms of real democratic principles. However, nonetheless, I think that I at least haven't found a nifty word that replaces civil society, captures the degree of contestation and division within civil society, and so on. And so the important thing for me is that when we're thinking about democratic deliberation, that we have to think not just of politicians and how they, you know, how they respond to demands, but we have to think about ordinary citizens and how they can formulate a vision of the collective good that represents their positions in a divided society, etc. And that this is a fundamental half of the problem of democracy that I think neoliberalism would like to shove under the rug. Even though neoliberalism, of course, can you know, is very friendly to certain kinds of quote-unquote civil society sorts of actions. Let me just say one word about Brazil. I do think that even though, obviously, the Workers' Party has attained a degree of hegemony which sort of threatens its old kind of social movement identity, it's nonetheless the case that the strength of civil society in Brazil is not the strength of a civil society which is completely subordinated to the Workers' Party by any stretch of the imagination. In part because the Workers' Party was not fundamentally a middle-class party, at least in its origin. It was indeed a Workers' Party. But also because strong contesters for defining the public good have remained relatively independent of the Workers' Party. I mean, the MST, the Movimento of Landless Workers, has very harsh, conflictful relationships with the Workers' Party, and yet has been able to project itself onto state policies in many ways nonetheless. And likewise, Biocchi, Heller, and Silva's recent book comparing different kinds of cities in Brazil looks at the effect of participatory institutions, holding constant the question of whether those institutions are occurring in cities which are dominated by the in which the Workers' Party has political control or not. And there's an independent effect of participatory institutions, an independent effect of the ability of civil society to act autonomously, which is very important. So I think that insofar as Brazil has been successful, the Workers' Party has in fact played a role, but to see civil society as simply the creature of the Workers' Party would be to deeply underestimate the character of civil society contestation in Brazil.
I think those questions were directed mainly to Peter. The only observation I would make is that there are many attempts to harness civil society, to bring them into the actual monitoring of institutions. And it'll be an interesting experiment to see where that works and where it doesn't. My sense is that in community policing, in a lot of these areas, the willingness to show up at so many night meetings declines with time, so that they tend to fall apart over time. And I am completely sympathetic to the citizens who get in this bind, but it has made me a little bit less enthusiastic than I used to be about the ability to draw civil society in as the salvation of state capacity in these periods.
We have Kate, and then Ken, and Mailing.
I'd like to thank both presenters for really stimulating presentations, and I thought the synergies between the two were more interesting still. The basic question I'd like to ask both of them is, where do we draw the line if we're focusing on the need for rebuilding the social contract, for increased and deepened engagement between civil society and the state? Where do we draw the line between co-production and neoliberal governmentality? If the idea is to help civil society engage with the state, to what extent is this happening in the pursuit of collective national goals between civil society and the state? And to what extent is it actually becoming a project of helping the state manage the expectations of civil society in order to conform them to neoliberal goals, which don't seem to have a lot to do with job creation, productive development, and do seem to focus a great deal on reducing democracy to basic service provision. Thank you very much.
Ken, you had a question?
Yeah. Thanks. This actually follows up a tad on previous round. So, but it just seems that this is directed to Peter as well. If we accept that there's this imperative for institutions that allow for deliberation to take place because of the information providing functions, performs, and so on, which I find to be entirely acceptable, a lot of the emphasis tends to be on creating opportunities to participate, and where that then leads us to is the obvious point that not everybody has the ability to participate, and sort of the capabilities for collective action are not sort of uniformly shared throughout society. So some actors are very easy for them to mobilize, some actors are very difficult, which is why you get this predicament that John points to about civil society being monopolized by sort of better-off groups. So my question to you then, Peter, is what are the ways to essentially help groups whose information and participation in these deliberative institutions is essential for in order to have the outcomes that you want, but that are burdened by collective action problems, to help them to be able to participate, with the caveat being you have to be able to do it in ways that don't distort other elements of democracy and don't distort representation and so on. It's not, I don't know if you're going to say this is something that's just as historically contingent, it's just the way these groups have developed, or whether there's a way to go about doing this other than essentially state subsidizing organization.
Sorry, and one last one quickly, mailing in the back.
Thank you. This is a question for Jennifer, and it's actually about the slide that happens to be up there, building a loyal opposition. So something obviously that's extremely important in an unconsolidated democracy or in an authoritarian regime that might be undergoing a transition. But I wanted to sort of take one of your initial questions and apply it to this, which is, under what circumstances is it actually incentive compatible for people who actually are in power to want to build a loyal opposition? It seems that often when you're in that moment, so you're coming from an authoritarian state or you're an unconsolidated democracy, people who are in power want to demolish, destroy the opposition, or to completely co-opt it. And one thing they could do is sort of use some of the things that you have up there as strategies for complete co-optation rather than for actually sort of building, masking what they're doing as building a loyal opposition, but actually be trying to completely co-opt the opposition on the one hand, and if that fails, destroy them. So I was just wondering if you had some thoughts on the circumstances or the point at which it actually becomes incentive compatible for those in power to actually want to build a loyal opposition.
Peter, do you want to say that?
Sure. tough questions. Let me say first in response to Kate's question. Obviously, this is one of the sort of dilemmas, again, having to do with this kind of amorphous character of civil society. In other words, civil society can be a foundation for contestation, but it is also the case that neoliberal ideologies elevate civil society as, let's go to civil society and use it precisely as the antithesis to contestation. In other words, the trade union movement, that's a particular interest, and we want instead civil society, right? So it's obviously a slippery kind of political dialogue that you always have to be careful to look at what people are actually saying and doing. I would argue that in some ways the relationship between neoliberalism and civil society is sort of analogous to the relationship between neoliberalism and democracy. In other words, I think that neoliberalism is in fact quite good when it comes to opposing repression, particularly by sort of free capitalist sorts of states. Neoliberalism is quite good at saying, hey, states should not be capriciously repressive, and state power should be limited, and civil society should have more space, and so on. So quite good in some respects, but then again, it flips around. And when civil society begins to contest the power of capital or economic allocation of resources or something like that, then it suddenly ceases to be civil society in neoliberal view. It becomes class warfare or something, something quite sort of reprehensible and anti-liberal, right? So it's a problem. I don't have the solution. I'm not really good. Neoliberal governmentality is a sort of tricky concept for me to begin with, but I think you have pointed to another one of these kinds of contradictions in relation to civil society that's very important. In terms of Ken's question, I would say the answer is similar to the answer that the young violinist received to her question of how do I become a great concert violinist, right? And the answer is practice, 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 right? And I think that applies to some sense even more to questions of participation and of increasing people's capacity to participate. I think that while it is true that there's sort of meeting fatigue and so on and so forth, in fact, if people feel that their participation actually affects the distribution of important material goods, people figure out how to participate, learn how to participate, groups organize, and I mean, if you look, for example, at Jim Holston's work on marginal slum communities in São Paulo, the degree to which these groups, given the slightest opening for participation, are able to learn, Brazilian legal rules, which are so complicated, I wouldn't even try to learn them, become the equivalent of jailhouse lawyers, etc. The extent to which people's capacity to participate can be grown once there is an opportunity, and once that opportunity seems to have returns. And these are not, people subsidized by the state. The state would just as soon take their land and forget it. But if there is a sense of real return, and that is part of my argument about the way in which neoliberalism undercuts the possibilities of real democratic deliberation, because neoliberalism takes out of the publicly contested sphere most of the resources. Every time you privatize a service, every time you cut the revenues to government and rely on the private sector to do something instead, every time you do that, the returns to democratic participation diminish. And so, if you look at something like participatory budgeting in Brazil, what's pathetic is what a small amount of total resources get into that sphere. It's still true that even that small amount affects people's lives materially, and therefore people participate. But it is the case that in my view, one of the negative consequences of neoliberalism for building participation is it reduces the degree to which that participation can have substantial material effects on people's lives.
So I think difficult and important questions. I might phrase some of them a little bit differently, but certainly the underlying issue in both sets of questions is about how restricted the public debate becomes under different scenarios. I think I view the focus on services a little bit less negatively than you all do. Maybe I'm part of the neoliberal conspiracy here, but if the alternative is attacks against the rights of people of other ethnic groups or other religious groups, if democratic debate can't be sorted out from incendiary remarks or attacks on other people, then I think that gets different, difficult. And I think that's really what we're trying to do here, that there are certain kinds of appeals that are not an acceptable part of democratic discourse. You can't have deliberation if those are true. So how do you filter that out? And maybe a focus on things like healthcare and education become terribly important. But I don't have the answer to that. Certainly in the real case, James brought this up earlier, what is actually going on in these Imihigo meetings and the contracts formed, and I've been concerned about that one. So is it an attempt to build a contract over the provision of public goods to get people focused on the common weal, or is it an attempt to restrict participation? And it could well be an element of both. It could easily go off in either direction. So I'm not sure. So I think we have to watch that. I would say that there are some... I guess I don't view the narrowness as
as destructive as you all do. I think there are just limited numbers of things that low-capacity governments can do, and big bureaucracies that try to do a lot are doomed to become rent collectors or highly dysfunctional, and that is likely to produce much more conflict. However, I also don't agree with those who say privatize everything, and I think in most of the countries in which I'm working, at least, the option to privatize is often not there because there's not a flourishing public or private sector either. So what you're really talking about are the creation of semi-autonomous agencies of some sort. This gets identified very often with the new public management, which many say corporatization, that's part of the neoliberal